Welcome to the Writer's Weekly Podcast, a forum geared toward the writing enthusiast and those who want to make money from their writing. I'm Brian Whidden, Managing Editor of Writer's Weekly, and I'll be your host along with Angela Hoy, the creator of Writer's Weekly and President and CEO of BookLocker.com, a full-service book publishing company. Whether you want to learn how to become a professional writer, how to find writing gigs, or even publish your own book, then you come to the right place. We'll be discussing all kinds of topics relating to the writing and publishing industries. Don't forget, you can also click over to writersweekly.com. There, you'll find not only thousands of articles about professional writing, you can also find current paying markets and job listings to help you boost your writing career and even your bottom line. But for now, let's get on to this episode of the Writer's Weekly Podcast. And welcome to another episode of the Writer's Weekly Podcast. I'm Brian Whidden, and with me is, once again, Angela Hoy.
Here.
So, we're finally back. Actually, we were back last week, but we didn't do a home office, so we're going to do that now. We're going to shoot through three things real quick. Number one, COVID.
Wasn't that a blast?
It sucks.
My voice still isn't normal.
I'm still coughing stuff
up.
Yeah,
if you hear me sniffing and snorting, and I can't help it. So
yeah. So I got it first. We think at Vacation Bible School because I spent a week there working with the kids there, and
you do security at the church.
And then I gave it to Angie. So just about the time I was starting to feel just a little bit better, she was.
I actually migrated to the guest room, but it didn't work.
No.
Yeah.
No. But we're better now. So
much better now.
It was 2 weeks of hell.
And this was our fifth bout with it.
Yeah.
I think we're getting better each time.
It's not as bad each time.
Yeah,
I remember the first time we got it, before anybody knew what it was, we got it in 2019. We lived on a boat, and man, I thought it was going to kill me.
Remember we made a promise not to go to the hospital?
Yep.
Yeah, because it was that bad. And
We've done that twice now. We've been so bad, we actually had the discussion and said, no hospitals, no respirators.
Yeah, right. Because when we've got it the first time, there were already rumors of it, you know, coming out of China. And we knew, Mason got it first, and he was part of a theater group, and we knew what it was before they even announced it was on our shores. So,
yep.
No hospitals. Hey, it's worked.
It has
worked.
We're
still alive, yeah.
And then chickens. Tell us about chickens.
They grow so fast.
Yep.
And they poop so much.
They do.
They're at what, a month old now?
Just about a month.
They've quadrupled.
Yeah.
I think tomorrow they'll be a month old. They've quadrupled in size.
These little things that used to just fit into the palm of our hands, you now got to grab them with two hands just to hang on, and they'll flap around and kick.
They try to fly away.
Man.
I caught one in midair. Did I already talk about that on a previous episode?
Well, I think you tried to talk about it
last week when we had that failed recording. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was one we had to tape up her toes, or his toes. Actually, we think that might be a rooster. And Brian had gone to get some other supplies and left him or her in a Home Depot bucket at my feet on the back porch. And I was on my phone, I think on Facebook. And all of a sudden, I dropped my phone and reached out, just instinct, and grabbed it in midair. It flew out of that bucket. So they can fly just fine.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm afraid if we don't grab them fast enough, bye, chicken. Never see you again.
But they're about the size of quail now.
Maybe even bigger. Yeah, they're growing so fast.
Yeah.
They're adorable.
Oh, they're cute. They're
still
really cute.
Yep.
And so, and it's like, they hate being picked up, but once you like cuddle them up against you and start petting them, they'll just like squat down in your hand and just kind of lay
up.
And just cuddle. Yeah.
Yeah, and they stop cheep, cheep, cheep. When you hold them,
they get
really quiet, and they'll look you in the eye. And like, don't call me mommy because we might need to eat you someday. So anyway, they're doing great. They're doing fantastic.
Okay, item number three. This happened this week.
This is a serious topic.
Now we're getting serious. And this is not the first time it's happened. I mean, you've been in business 25 plus years, so you've seen it before. This time, I think, was a little more intense, so you passed it on to me.
Yeah.
Occasionally, we will get an email from somebody who is either hinting to or flat out threatening suicide.
Yeah.
And this one was actually flat out telling us how they were, what they were going to do, how they were going to do it.
Exactly what weapon, where the weapon was. Yeah. Very, very detailed. And the first time this ever happened was I rejected a man's manuscript through BookLocker. He had submitted his manuscript to BookLocker, and it was not of the quality that we require. So I sent him, you know, very friendly, professional, bless you, rejection, you know, explain why we couldn't publish his book. And he wrote back and he said, well, if I can't even get pay somebody to publish my book, I'm just going to kill myself. Yep. Now, I tried to find him online somewhere. I could not locate him. I tried. He, of course, he never responded to me. I never heard from him again. I don't know what happened to him. When we do get these types of emails, we don't just discard them. We act on them. And
yeah, this one you gave to me because of how direct he was. Well, I don't know who it was because they didn't give us a name or location or anything.
It's both searched for the email address. Nothing email came address. Up. We have no idea where this person was.
So I did send a response, part sympathetic, part just direct. Hey, listen, you got to get some help.
And he was upset because nobody will publish his writing. He wanted to be a writer, but he's not able to.
Yeah, basically, I love to write. I love to write about everything. I just want people to read my writing. And then he just goes into talking about wanting to kill himself. Yeah. So they never got to the point where they're saying, you know, if nobody will publish my writing or read my, I don't even know what they wanted.
Yeah.
Really.
They
especially
weren't
for
trying
me.
To get us to buy their writing, unless it was like a sympathy ploy, which I've seen that before.
So I just directly told him, I said, you know, you really need to go. And I even sent some suicide hotline phone numbers.
Yeah.
I said, you need to call one of these. Get to go. Cause you're in this place where right now you're thinking of everything emotionally and you need somebody that can look at your situation unemotionally and help walk you through it because mm-hmm. you ain't thinking right.
Yeah.
It's a tough position to be in, but we do have a policy. If we can figure out who you are, we are going to help you get help.
We are going to notify the authorities.
Yeah.
Because
I'm not a therapist. Mm-hmm. I can't. And we certainly aren't going to be strong armed into publishing somebody's book that's no good or
even an article.
Anything.
Just because you say if we don't. And again, this person did not say that.
Yeah.
But I have received similar emails over the years that subtly suggested, you know, if you don't publish my article, I'm just going to go kill myself.
Well, that's the one that's what kind of worried me about this one is they didn't lay down any kind of condition. It
right.
was just, let me tell you about how I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah, I've tried it before. I'm going to do it again.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, yeah, this sounds pretty serious.
Yeah,
because he's not
very
even
detailed.
Asking. Well,
let's bring up when our son Mason was 17 years old.
Go ahead.
And we wrote about it on Writers Weekly. No, he did not try to kill himself. He saved another teenager from killing himself. It was, again, I wrote about it on Writers Weekly. We'll put a link to that article under this podcast. But Mason was only 17 and came to me one day and said, Mom, I've got this friend online that I play games with, and he told me he's going to kill himself. And I said, okay, pull up your account. Let me read all the correspondence. And I did. And this child was serious. I could tell it was serious. And I told Mason, okay, put on your detective hat. You need to get him to tell you where he lives. Now, kids are instructed not to give people their address and stuff online. I said, tell him, you know, things are going to get better and that you want to send him a gift to make, you know, his day brighter. And that worked. Mm. So Mason, within an hour or two, was able to obtain the kids, not only his address, but his phone number. We called the local police department, talked to the dispatcher, and they jumped. They immediately sent a police car to that boy's home, and he admitted to the authorities that he was suicidal, and he was planning it, and he had it all planned out. And his poor parents, I can't imagine what they went through that night. And he was transported to a mental health facility that night, and he got the care he needed and the meds he needed, and he is a happy, thriving young man today.
Yeah.
And so why I wanted to add that was we don't just sit back and click delete or write back, hope you have a better day, because that's not what good people do. If we can find, if you send us an email like that and we can find out who you are, and we have other ways other than just looking for an email address, if we can find out who you are and where you are, you're going to get a knock at the door because you need help.
Yeah.
And we're not qualified to give that help, but we sure know who to contact who is.
Yeah. And just to wrap this up, I guess, we live in a crazy enough world. Things are rough. Me personally, my philosophy is kind of that I think human beings, we've kind of pushed past the edge of what I think God intended us to try to wrap our brains around. All the technology and all the philosophical and political ideologies
being bombarded by everything.
With everything, is I think we have gone way beyond what God intended us to be doing. But you know, that's where we are. You know, killing yourself, that's a one-time deal.
Yep.
Everything else you do in life, you can screw it up and then say, oh, okay, that didn't work, and then try something different. Suicide, yeah, it's one shot, one time. That's it. You never get a redo on that.
And if you think about all the horrible things you've been through in your life, anybody has been through in their lives, it's absolutely true. This too shall pass.
Yeah.
No matter how stressful it is, no matter how painful it is, there is going to be another chapter.
Yep.
Unless you do something stupid that's going to hurt not just you, but going to permanently hurt everybody who cares about you.
To boil that down, you know, no matter what's going on, it ain't worth ending your life. I mean, right, it's just, you know, and some things never go away, but you have to learn to separate your intellectual thoughts from your emotional thoughts so that you can look at what you're doing, what's going on emotionally, and recognize, wait a minute, that's not worth all the anguish I'm putting myself through. Yeah.
And that's why we encourage anyone going through this, and so many more people are the way the world is today, that, you know, reach out for help. If you don't know where to reach out for help, go to writersweekly.com, click on the contact us button, ask for me or Brian, and we will provide you with the resources to get help.
Yeah. And that's why we say what we do is if you send us something talking about you're going to kill yourself, we're going to go out of our way to make sure you can get that help if we can figure out who you are and where you are, because
and you'd be surprised at Brian's research skills.
Yeah,
I mean, not only was he a cop, but he's like this super nerd.
So anyway, that is Home Office, and we're going to move on now to this week's episode. We're going to be talking to one of our authors from Book Locker.
One of our most prolific authors.
Well, yeah, his name is Thomas Berry. And Thomas received a Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy from, I'm going to try this here, St. Bonaventure University.
He takes
pleasure in extensively researching both historical fiction and nonfiction stories in his spare time. He enjoys long-distance running, something I absolutely hate to do myself, and competed in several marathons, something you will never see me do. He currently lives with his wife and children in New Jersey, and he has written 7 books for us since 2020.
Yeah.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good, good, Ryan and Angela. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you here on the Writers Weekly podcast.
Honor to have you. We've known each other for such a long time.
I know it. I know it. I first got published in 2010, so it's been 15 years working with Book Locker and Angela. And I've been so happy with everything. And I've written 7 books, and just keep on
keep on keeping on. That's what we always say.
Well, Tom, for starters, you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I am a father of 5. I'm from New Jersey, and I've always loved reading as a kid, and I think that's kind of sparked my interest in books in general. I was a very avid reader. I would get to the point where I could read a book a day as a kid.
And you live near some train tracks.
Yes, yes. Can't control that.
But, well, we did too in Maine. We had a train track right in the backyard. It was awesome. Yeah.
But I got to the point where I was in my mid-30s, and I decided I can probably write stories better than the books that I'm reading. And so I decided to dabble in it. And I said, well, what is it that I can write about? You know, and So I started writing with small stories about kids because I have five kids, and that's kind of where my interest peaked. And then as I kind of worked through that, I was very interested in history. And I decided that's kind of where I wanted to focus my stories. And each book that I've done has been a different genre, a different, not just a part of history, but a different way of writing. The first book was about Lewis and Clark. It was a murder mystery. So the idea there was I wanted to explore history, but do it in a way that was exciting for me as a writer, not just say this is the history book version of what happened. I wanted to do it in a story with characters, and I wanted to do it with my own twist on it. You know,
I'm still getting over COVID. It takes a special kind of author to be able to write historical fiction. First of all, you have to know that history, and then inserting characters, details, you know, clothing, weather elements at the time, all of these things into an actual event that really happened has always fascinated me. I don't think I could ever write historical fiction, but it's one of my favorite genres to read, and which is why we love your books. You've done a fantastic job with those.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
And also, I had to read all about Lewis and Clark. And when I lived in Texas, also about the Alamo. I've been to the Alamo several times. That's one of your books is also about that. In Texas, we had a big, gigantic history book called Texas History. So, and I have to tell you that your books are way better than that one was.
Well, thank you.
More interesting.
I appreciate that, Angela. Thank you. Thank you. It means a lot. You know, and I've always loved history. And the idea was that those are the books that I'd like to read because I want to learn. But I don't want to do it in just a textbook way. I want to explore it with characters and dialogue and motivations and passions. So that's the kind of book that I decided to write about because I want to write a book that interests me. But also, I think there are other people out there that like to read history and learn it in that way. And I've gotten a lot of feedback over the years, and people really gravitate towards that style of historical fiction.
I think that's very good advice for any author. Write the book that you would want to read, especially one that's, you know, not already on the market.
Now, I noticed that all the books that you have with us do focus on a period of war or struggle. And when I was going over that, I remembered a class I took in college, a writing class. And one of the things that always stuck with me that professor said was, if you're going to write about war, write about one man's war. In other words, it's one thing to start talking about all the statistics and this happened and this army moved over here. But when you get into the experiences of just one person in a wartime theater, it brings out so much more in that writing. It brings the reader into it much better than, you know, the 101st Airborne went into the, you know, Ardennes forest and they were really, really cold and da 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 da. You know, it's a different, you know, and I think that's what you captured with your books here.
Yeah, Tom, you've really personalized the stories.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ryan and Angela. Making it personal is very important for the reader too, because they get invested in that character and they look at it from that character. And if you look at it from an overview, that's one thing, but you really got to personalize it. And that's how I kind of viewed my books.
Now, before we jump into your books, and I think
you wanted to ask a question.
Can I ask one first? You do yours first. Go ahead.
I want to, and a lot of authors are going to, so many authors struggle to write one book their entire life, and they want to know what your secret is to being a prolific author.
I have been asked this too, and really it comes down to consistency. If people wait for a block of time every day, they need 3 hours to write, they'll never do it, because in the course of a day, nobody has that much of time.
And that's and true.
So what I do is I say, I'm going to do an hour a day, half an hour a day, whatever it is, it's in small doses, but it's every day, and it can consistent, and every day turns into a book within a few years. You know, each whether it's research of a book you're reading or you're learning more about it. And then when you get down to the writing, it's you write a page a day, two pages. It's maybe not a whole lot, but it's something. And the more that you do it, and you get into the habit of doing it, you're going to come up with something in the end that's really good. And you're not putting it off. So people get quite a block. They say, well, I don't know what to write about, or I don't know, or I don't have the time. And the way that I say it is that you carve out a small amount of time every day. You outline what it is that you want to do, whether you want to write this book and or write this chapter. And I know this is what is going to happen when the chapter starts. This is what I want to happen at the end of the chapter. And so you kind of avoid the writer block by being very detailed in your outline. And you say, this is what I want to do. And if I want to...
All right, he froze up a little bit. Let's wait and see what happens here.
Can you hear me now?
There
okay,
you
I
are.
Okay, I can hear you now.
I have a question. Do you start out with a master outline before you start the writing process, or do you create a new outline for each chapter, or do you have a master outline and then it kind of changes as the writing process goes along?
I have a master outline. It's not every chapter is there for a purpose, and the outline shows that and say, this is what the chapter is going to be. This is why it's there in the book. It's going to do this. Now, within that chapter, I don't have as much details in the master. That's more organic, but I do know what's going to, you know, the inputs to it and the outputs to it. Within the chapter, I'd like to be more organic because that's more dialogue, that's more emotions in the moment. And I don't always know what's going to happen necessarily within that chapter as far as what the characters do or feel or say until I get there. But I do have a master outline.
So, well, that actually makes the writing process more fun, in my opinion. And it's always fun when your characters surprise you, isn't it?
It does. It does. Yeah. And, you know, and I would like to throw the reader twist now and then, because I don't want the reader to get too predictable and you know, this is what will happen in X, Y, and Z. Sometimes or organically I want to throw a twist in there so that it's more of a cliffhanger for the next chapter. People will want to keep reading because they say, oh well, what's gonna happen? I don't know.
And that's so, very important. Yeah.
Even in things like where you know what the outcome is, like in the Alamo book. People know in general terms what happened, but they don't know the details. And I wanted to do a story that really explores what they don't know and do it in a personal way with characters and say, this is what it was like to live in that time, to live in the, not just the culture, but the politics and the personalities that come out of it. Because so many times it's the people, it's the personalities that really define the book. And and it's not just history. Those you can't see in a history book, the personalities of the people behind it. And many times those are the ones that are making the big D decisions and making the history come alive.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, let's use that right there to kind of work our way into your first book, which was about Lewis and Clark. Actually, Meriwether Lewis kind of focuses on something that a lot of people don't know, and that was he was found dead under some suspicious circumstances. And I studied up on this a little bit and found that he actually, through his life, had some characteristics that now we recognize potentially as a bipolar disorder. Yes. And I'm going to let you take it from there.
Yes, yes. At the time, he was, personality-wise, he was very focused on the details. And that's where he was, when they were on the expedition. He was more the detail guy about exploring the fauna and the forest and the wildlife. And Clark, his partner, he was more focused on the bigger picture, and I think
if I'm correct, I believe Clark was a prior military man, and I think Lewis was like a surveyor or something like that. Am I wrong?
Yes, Yes, yes. And they were hired by President Jefferson to explore the new territory that they got from France, Louisiana Purchase. And, okay. And they wanted to explore it and see what was out there. Ultimately, they really wanted to see if there was a river that went from the East Coast all the way through to the West Coast, because that would make trade much easier. And so that was his primary objective. So they kind of went by river up the Missouri River and all of that. But that was their focus. But Lewis was very much the, his personality was very much in the bipolar. He would be pressed at times, and that he would be very focused and detailed at times, and that was his personality. What ultimately led to his death was, but he was out about 5 years after they came back. He was governor of the Illinois Territory, and he was facing financial ruin, and he was going to Washington D.C. and he decided to he was going by boat, and he decided at one point to go across the Natchez Trace, which is a pioneer trail going from Mississippi to Tennessee. It was a shortcut. And so he was having some issues that people really, really didn't know about. If you just look at the expedition, you know, he was an explorer, but he was also a man with a lot of personality traits that were interesting, and history that was interesting to explore. And
he had some issues.
Yes, yes. And I wanted to explore that. And I knew that his death was officially a suicide, but there was a lot of people that thought it was murder for different reasons. So I wanted to explore that. So I really dug into it. And in the book, I have my own theories, but the way that I wanted to do it, and it's explored in the book, but I wanted to take some explorers that were on the expedition and put them in the War of 1812, a few years later, and they would explore their friend's death. And so it was really personal for them. And I wanted to explore not just Lewis, but these other four guys and their friendships and the way that their personalities clashed or joined. And so that's what really makes the story come alive, because you're also, and it was a book of alternate timelines. You would go back and forth from the expedition to the investigation that happened in the War of 1812, and then back again. So that by the end, you're really going to understand not just what they did on the exploration, but also what happened in the War of 1812, which is my fictional part of it, because this part of it with these four guys in investigating this was my fictional part of it, but it was based on real life people. It was based on real life events and places, and that's what.
Well, that's another testament to your talent as an author, because a lot of authors are not able to jump timelines back and forth.
Yeah,
and you did a great job with it, and that's not easy.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So the title of that book, and that was your first book with us, I believe, in 2010, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Is Lewis and Clark: Murder on the Natchez Trace?
Yes.
When I was doing a little bit of studying on it, I think even Clark, based on his years with him out there in the wilderness, said there's no way he killed himself, and that's what kind of caused the dispute over whether he actually killed himself or somebody murdered him. So excellent way to kind of build on that and going into the War of 1812 as well.
Yes. And I just wanted to also add too, from an author's point of view, I wanted to start off with these four guys, but rather than just say, all right, this is, John and William. And I had each of them introduced in the book by their own story. And they each had a chapter about what was going on with them at the time. They were in battle. They were dealing with Indians. They were on the Constitution, on the ship. They were dealing with Tecumseh. And then they were joined together. But by that time, you already knew their characters because they were explored briefly in these other stories. So that way, you know, when they are together, and William Clark sits them down and he says, this is what I want you to do, is investigate the murder of Lewis. The reader already knows what they're about. And to me, that was an important way of introducing the book.
That was a great idea. Yeah.
Okay, so your next book was titled Texas Freedom, Texas Freedom, Last Stand at the Alamo.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us what kind of twists you threw into that?
Well, I wanted to focus on a story that not many people knew what really happened. People know in general the Alamo and the Mexicans and the everybody died. But I wanted to find out what really happened. And to do that, I read the old reports that the Mexican soldiers filed after they came back. And because there's a lot of mythology about what happened. And then there is a lot of people that say, well, this happened and that happened, but it really didn't. Or this character was there. And I wanted to clear up a lot of that, but doing it in a story way where I wanted to focus on a couple, Susanna and Almiron Dickinson, who were actually there. Susanna was in fact allowed to leave at the end, and she want her purpose was to send a message to Sam Houston, who was the general attempting to build an army against the Mexicans, to let them know what had happened. And but the idea was that they had Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie, and
who were some very interesting characters themselves.
I have a question.
Yes.
Were the reports you read from the Mexicans written in Spanish?
No, they were.
Or you found them translated online, or what?
Yes. Found them online through the embassy in Mexico. They had the details. So I had them sent to me.
I bet a lot of the research you did before you even started writing the books was a lot of fun, because people that are into history are into doing the research. So I bet you had a lot of fun with that.
I did. And there's so much that you pick up as you go along. When I started off this book, I thought, well, let me explore this, because I didn't know much about it. And the more that you read, the more that you learn, it was just fascinating. And what really put the cap on it for me was I actually went out to the Alamo to talk to the historians, and I did it on the weekend of the 175th anniversary of the attack.
So wow. That weekend,
there were hundreds of reenactors from all over the country.
I bet that was awesome.
And that was, it was. There were people that were dressed up as on either side, as the Mexicans or as the Texans, and many of them were history professors that I talked to, and they really knew their stuff, and they knew their costumes. I was able to take hundreds of photos of all of those costumes, so that way they can make their way into the book. As I'm talking about a book, you know, the Mexican soldiers, their outfits were actually taken from the French. So they were very colorful. They were, you know, reds and blues, and they had the hats and all of that.
Tall hats, and yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Now, would that have been derived from Napoleon's army uniforms?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. And the idea was that Santa Anna, who was the leader of the Mexican army, he was a very colorful character too, and his personality was very brash. He was ambitious. He was strong-headed and determined. And he built an army. He was, when the Texans they captured the mission there at the Alamo, when they would just want to put up a stand, and Santa Anna took that as a personal offense, and he kind of took his army up there, 3,000 soldiers against 150 Texans, And so the numbers were all in his favor, but he still waited until he had everybody there, and he captured, or he surrounded them, and he made a very grand stand. And so that was his personality. And then after the battle, I detailed in the book what happened there. And I'm not going to go into that because I don't want to spoil it. But there's a lot of history there, a lot of characters. Davy Crockett, people know about him in a very general way. But really, when you get into his personality, he was a politician. Mm-hmm. And he was a backwoodsman, but he didn't like that. He wanted to be taken seriously. And it was his detractors in government that said, this is Davy. He's a backwoodsman. He's a hick. And he didn't like that because he wanted to be, you know, David. And he wanted to be, I can work with the government and be a an official and help people out. But so the Davy Crockett that we know in history is different than the man, different than what he wanted to be. And so I find that fascinating.
I have the song going through my head right now. Davy Crockett. I'll do the background silent songs. Y'all keep talking.
All right. Well, your next book after that was Over the Mountain. And again, I did a little bit of research into your character. This is a more biographical account, if I'm correct. And it talks about Donald Malloy, who actually died back in 2012, and he was a B-17 bomber pilot awarded the Distinguished Unit Citation for a bombing raid against Poznan, Poland, which is an interesting mission there. I'll let you take it.
Well, he was my grandfather. And
oh my gosh. I should have just shut up and let you tell all about it. I didn't know that you were related. Wow. Okay.
Yeah Tom, you buried the lead on that one.
Huh? Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, so tell us about this. Yeah, because that is an interesting story. Yeah.
It is. And I wanted to tell his story because he would come home and he would always have a lot of stories. This is what this happened, that happened. And he was getting on in years, and I wanted to make sure that we got his stories down in writing before he passed on. And I wanted, and so that was actually very, very, very important to me. So I did the research, and I interviewed him, and I got what he was saying. But I also went further, and I dug deeper and deeper into, you know, how he was trained as a pilot, and with the mission that he flew, and the people that he was with. And he was captured. He was a POW, and he escaped. He was recaptured again, escaped again. So all of those stories, I really got the.
Where was he shot down? Where did he actually go down?
Switzerland.
In Switzerland, and then captured by the Germans.
No, there. he was on a bombing raid in Germany, and his plane got hit by flak, and he was able to cross over the border to Switzerland, and he was captured by the Swiss, which is which was actually a neutral country at the time. And so they would capture both sides, really, but they would kind of let the Germans go because they knew that they were surrounded by Axis countries. So but the Americans, they would hold. And they would.
I never knew.
I did not know that.
I did not know that. So
Switzerland was snatching up both sides and putting them in prison camps. Wow.
Yes.
Did he talk about how the treatment was in the POW camps? Was it okay there?
Yeah. And the investigation that I delved into, the first one that he was in, he was a POW camp high in the Alps. And they kind of used the Alps, the mountains, as the walls. They didn't really have a
natural fence. Barrier.
Yeah. But he escaped there with a buddy, but they were betrayed. And they were recaptured again, this time, again, by the Swiss. But when you're recaptured again, you were put in a much more stronger prison. And it was, and the commandant was actually a Nazi. and as I found out. And so he ran it like a Nazi prison camp. And but he still escaped. And but his story, you know, really dealt with not just the exploits of the people. He was in with Russians that were also captured, and he was in with other countries and other people. And you know, to me, it was fascinating about the details, but also the people that he was with and the stories and the bombing raids. He was on a bombing raid in Berlin, the very first bombing run that was ever made on the capital of Germany. But it wasn't an ordinary run. It was supposed to be three air groups, but two of them turned back because of the bad weather. But his army group went in. His Air Force group went in because they did not know that the other groups had left. So they thought, well, we've got all of this support, but they really didn't. And when you go in for the bombing raid, you have to go in one at a time, you know, over the target. So if they're sitting ducks for the anti-aircraft guns that were
at least if not the first plane, the second, third, fourth, because now the guns know where they're going to be.
Yes. And then once they drop their bombs and they have to head back, they're attacked by the Luftwaffe and you know, the German Air Force. So the fact that they got through and they bombed and they got back safely was incredible, because each plane has 10 men in it, from you know, gunners, bombers, pilots. So when one plane goes down, you lose 10 men. So in these big, huge raids, they would send up 600 planes and 400 come back. Well, you know, that's a loss of 2,000 men.
Yeah, in
one raid. So they had to be very specific about where they're going to hit, and they were, you know, the way that they dealt with alternating it with England. They would their base was in England, so the English would actually raid during the nighttime, and the Americans would raid during the daytime, which was more dangerous because you could see them and all. That, but this way they were keeping up a steady downpour of the bombs. But I also wanted to talk about the book that I wrote, Over the Mountain. It was about Don Molloy, my grandfather. And I segued that with two other individuals into Crosshairs, which was my next book that I did.
And, wait, can we go back to Over the Mountain? Because you mentioned the weather. And you even explain how he was from Vermont, which is, we lived in Maine for a while. Vermont's pretty darn cold.
Yeah.
I've been to Switzerland, and I've been on the mountains in Switzerland. They have snow on top of their mountains all summer long. It is really, really cold there.
Yes.
And you mentioned, let's see, Don must use all of his skills to escape numerous POW camps and make it home over the mountains. See, I'm not very well versed in military stuff like you guys are, but I'm really interested in survival stories. And that is the part that interests me the most about the whole description, is how did he get out? And of course, we're not going to give away the end, but it's really cold there. So,
Yes.
Well, and just one other little factoid here is that the bombing raid in Poznan, Poland, at that time, that was the longest distance bombing raid that the B-17s had engaged in.
Yes.
To date. In fact, here we are today looking at the fact that our B-2 bombers flew how many thousands of miles from the middle of America all the way over to Iran, bombed it, turned around, and came back, never once touching their wheels to the ground. How far we've come.
I know it. And the fact that they're up there in a plane that's not heated and it's freezing, and the only communication that they have with each other is really headsets or radios within the plane. But if
you get intercom,
and so it was a struggle, both, you know, training for it, getting over there, flying it. And these guys are young guys. They're their early 20s, late teens, and be responsible for all of this and put their lives on the line, not just in the Air Force, but, you know, Army and the Navy. But the Air Force was what I was focusing on in this story.
Okay, so then you wrote the book Crosshairs, and this is again World War II, but you expanded into a few other people. So tell us about that.
Yes. So there are also one of them is Air Force II, and he actually flew with John F. Kennedy's brother Joseph Kennedy, who was a Navy pilot, and he died during the war, but he was under top secret clearance. So nobody really knew what had happened, not even his father. And he was a very, 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 very important senator at that time, very powerful. But what happened now was that he was involved in the government program that was trying to fly remote control planes into fortified bunkers in northern France. Those bunkers were shooting up the V2 rockets that were landing in London, and so they were inter-ballistic missiles. They would go out up into space, come down, and there was no way to see them or stop them. So they wanted to attack these bunkers because France at that time was under Nazi rule. Mm-hmm. So the idea was that you could not just hit them, these bunkers, with ordinary bombs. It was too thick. So what they would do is they would load up a plane, a B-17, load it up with explosives and put it in the air. The pilot would jump out, and there was another plane behind it that was controlling it from a distance. And that plane with the bombs would kamikaze it right into the bunker. And blow up.
Original bunker buster.
Yeah. Right.
And this had
but so 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 just to repeat what you were saying is this wasn't somebody sitting on the ground flying this remote control plane. They actually had to have another plane nearby it or within a certain distance, so that the one guy is actually flying the plane you're in, but somebody's also in there with those remote controls flying the plane that's up ahead of them.
Yes.
That's the one they're going to send in to amazing. The ingenuity we came up with back then.
I know.
I wonder how many people even knew we had remote control plane capability back then, World War II.
Yeah. It's like the old suicide drones that we have now.
Yeah.
But much bigger. Mm-hmm. And this was called Project Aphrodite?
Yes.
I like that.
Of course you do.
And I'm not going to give away what his fate was, but I will say that this whole project was very new, and it was very trial and error. You know, the first time it didn't work, they would find out why. They would make an adjustment. It would go back up again. So a lot of lives were put at risk. A lot of people died. A lot of people, you know, it was just that way. But the idea was that we're in war, and this has to work. So no matter what it takes, you know, this is what we do.
I think World War II is probably the last war the United States had ever been in where we had that attitude, where whatever it took to win that war, we were going to do it. Exactly. Whatever the losses we were going to have to accept, we were going to accept it to win that war. And I think ever since then, we've kind of had cold feet about going all in.
Well,
that comes is to very war. True. That
Some
is very
people,
true.
Yeah. I wanted to add that in this book also, Crosshairs, you go into detail about the specific personalities of the characters, their personal lives, their challenges, which makes it even more interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just about an overview. This is what the characters are doing. This is one person's viewpoint, say, and they're playing football here and they're doing this, but they're scared because they just lost. They have to go up in the air tomorrow, but they lost some friends, and how are they feeling? So it's a personal level that I'm getting to. And that was an important part of writing this, is to tell an important story, but from a personal viewpoint.
And again, your grandfather's in this book as well.
Yes. So, yeah. So that made it even more personal because it was his story and I wanted to tell it the way it was. And, you know, and how important it was to tell that for my family, but also to for the general public.
Yeah, so it's almost like, well, the books are definitely connected because he, over the mountain, he escapes over the mountains, and then he pops up in Crosshairs as well. Yeah. That's after he's escaped the Snowcat Mountains. So, yeah, awesome. You can't read one book without the other one for sure.
And then exactly. you also discuss Frank Krause and his brothers.
Yes, yes. He was in army in Italy. So what he did was he went in right after D-Day, and he went down to Italy, and he fought from Rome all the way up to northern Italy. And so his story was also very personal because he had a brother who was also in the army. So what I did there was I talked to him and he shared with me a lot of the letters that he sent back and forth. So I used those letters as a personal avenue for the book so that the reader can kind of know not just his own story, but his relationship with his brother who was also there at that time.
What a blessing that you were able to obtain those letters. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And after I had done the interviews, but before the books came out, some of them had passed on. So I was able to kind of get their story kind of just in time. And now they're a permanent part of history and people can really know what they did. Because a lot of the time, these soldiers, when they came back from war, they don't want to talk about it. You know, it was a difficult time for them. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to make sure that these stories were told because they're important stories. They're personal, but they also have an important part of our history.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to let you, so you wrote three books that basically surround the Peloponnesian War.
Yeah. Good luck with that word.
And I'm going to just for the sake of time, I'm going to let you kind of talk about sort of all three books as a series,
yeah.
I guess.
And they all start with the words "gifts of the gods."
Gifts of the gods. So you have "gifts of the gods," iron and bronze. "Gifts of the gods," silver and gold, and then "gifts of the gods," fire and ash. Now, yeah. I believe it's all you have five main characters that are in all three of these books.
Yeah, each book has five characters who are all different. So you can read one book without having reading the other books, and it's fine. But they're better if you read them as a series, because you'll get it. You know, because they're intertwining sometimes. But the idea was that it was a 30-year war, so each book details about 10 years of the war each.
This was mainly between Sparta and Athens,
right? Right.
Back in about 480 BC.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about those two states because they were the two superpowers at that time. And I find it, and the more that I detailed and I researched about them, and I read a lot of books through that were actually written at the time, it wasn't just history books now that were written by historians then, and so that really showed me what really happened, which is always my viewpoint. When I go into any project, I want to know the truth, what really happened, not what people say happened, you know, because that can change over time. But I want to know how it was. But I also want to tell it from a personal viewpoint. So you're going to get from many sides. Some of the characters are from Athens. Some of them are from Sparta. Some of them are just neutral. But their lives are uprooted by this war. And so the idea was that there is no good side or bad side. There is just war, and it's hard on everybody. And what personalities shape this war, because like anything else, officials, government are done by man. Man has personalities. And in this conflict, there was a lot a lot of that too. There was people that made choices that were based on their ambition. They were, you know, or their fear of this or that. So you really kind of get into it. But what was to me very intriguing was that the overall arc of the war really paralleled our own 20th century with US and Russia. They were the two superpowers that in our time, Athens and Sparta were the superpowers of their time. And they both had head-to-head conflicts. They both had, in my second book, they both supported war away from home.
Like so that proxy was our, wars.
That was our Vietnam, you know, mm-hmm. where both of us were fighting each other, but far off in the other country. And Athens and Sparta, they were both battling over Sicily. And so they were fighting there. But it was the same ideas that they learned. Hey, if we go head to head like we did, a lot of people will be dying. If we fight far off, we can do that because it's not here in our own place, you know. But the idea is that general support for this war back home means everything. In Vietnam, you know, we didn't have that support back yeah. home. And in their time, they, you know, they would send off these military ships, these fleets of hundreds of ships, and they thought, well, we'll go over and we'll conquer. And they didn't, and they lost support in a huge way back home. And how that affected their outcome and what happened over there really parallels what we do here in Vietnam. So to me, you know, we're learning. We are. This is what happens when you have these large countries, large cities that battle each other, and it's still going on now in some ways. But I just found the parallel was fascinating to me.
I want to add that Gift of Gods, Gifts of the Gods, Iron and Bronze is an award-winning book.
Yes.
And there's, because I was reading through the descriptions, there's something in these books for everyone, including romance fans like myself, because it says the harem girls in a Persian court meet a handsome foreigner and one risks everything for a chance at love. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm definitely reading that book. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Well, in this battle that they had, there was a Athenian official, Alcibiades, and he was everything you could want as a writer. He was, and his personality was so over the top, and his ambition had no ends. But he was also a romantic. He was a war hero. He was everything that you wanted to write for, and it's all true. And so many times, you know, the stories that you write about, he's in every book in some way, but. You know, but you have these characters that you find, and they're fascinating to write about and to tell their stories.
Yeah, just awesome. Yeah.
And the Olympics back in those days, you know. Was,
I was going to mention this was during the times of the Olympics. Yeah.
Yes. So my book touches on that as well. And what the people from that time in the Olympics were true characters. They were true people. They were fighters. They were chariot drivers, and the way that it was done and the way that I tell it is real to life. It's far, you know, in those times they would have big camps where people would sit and they would watch it. They would live there for a few weeks, and it was just fascinating. And then, you know, of course, what we have now is different, but it's the same idea. And the idea,
I was gonna say, it sounds the same, except these days our athletes wear clothes, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes. In those days, because of potential cheating, they made sure that they were naked. But in those days too, there was only men who could do the events, and they only had 9 events at that time. But they were.
I seem to remember reading somewhere that only men could watch the events
too. Yes, exactly.
Which I'm sure is a big disappointment for Angela.
That was totally unfair to women everywhere.
Well, in my book, I addressed that. There was, and this is also true, there was one guy who was a boxer, but his mother was his manager. And
interesting.
And this is true. And he won. But his mother, of course, couldn't be there, was not supposed to be there, but she dressed up in a cape, and so people didn't know it. But they found out, because when he won, her robe got torn off, and people saw, you know, and so the officials there say, well, you know, it's punishable.
This is highly irregular.
Yes. And that's based on historical accuracy.
Yes, that was.
That really happened.
That actually happened. Yes, yes.
You're teaching people all kinds of stuff we didn't know about.
Yeah. And I'm no expert on the Peloponnesian War, but I do know a little bit about the fact that Sparta and Athens were such completely different cultures.
Exactly. Yes.
And yet they were both the tough guys on the block. Athenians were known for their philosophy and their government structure and right. their civics. And Sparta was all about war, fight, tough guy, you know, badass, right. all this. But that clash lasted a while. Now the Sparta, I believe, did win eventually. Yeah. But Athens gave them a good run for their money.
Yes, and you're right. They had very different political structures. Cultures, but they both, to me, the idea was years before, they both had the same problem. Okay, they had the masses were poor, and the people that were in power had too much power. They had too much land. They owned too much. What do you do? And the Athenians, you know, said, well, we'll give more power to the people. So they created more of a democracy. Mm-hmm. And the Spartans said, well, we're going to divvy up everything equally. So they created socialism.
Socialism, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
And so those ideas kind of sprang out into what they saw down the road. Socialism turned into military and conservatism. They did not explore really. They were very much a private city that did not want outside influence at all, because they were afraid of corruption by other ideas, and we've seen that with China, Russia, the same idea. And Athens wanted to explore. They were all about democracy, but also finding and immersing with other cultures, and so the ideas there is more democratic. You would see that more in America. So the idea.
So history may.
Yeah.
So history may not repeat itself, but it certainly does rhyme.
Right. Right. But how they had the same problem and they went about it from two different ways, and how that grew into what we have. There was no right or wrong. It's just the way that they solved their problem.
Sure.
So I find that interesting, because nowadays we find things that it's us or it's them, and we hate them because they're different than us. But really, we're all people trying to solve our own problems in our own way. And some ways might not be as good as other ways from our viewpoint. But we're all people, and we're all trying
to
live on this world in our own way. And so that's what I was really focusing on in this book, that because my characters are from both sides, and you're going to see that I'm not bad because I'm on one side or the other side. I'm just a person living my life, and I'm impacted. I have characters who are slaves and they went to be free, people that were free and became slaves, people that were women and men and all different things. And you find out that we're all in this struggle together.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to The Blue Line to Richmond. That's your last book that you've written for us.
Also an award-winning book.
2024 International Impact Book Award for Historical Fiction in the War and Military category.
Yeah. And well-deserved.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. This is in the Civil War.
Yes. I wanted to write a book about the Civil War, but everybody knows about the war in a general sense. They know who won, and they know more or less kind of what happened. But I wanted to focus on little known stories that people made an important impact in the war that people can still learn about and find it interesting, fascinating. And so I started off with reviewing Paul Revere, who was the actual grandson of the Revolutionary War legend that we all knew. And he was from Massachusetts, from the Boston area, and he fought with the Harvard Regiment, which was a regiment that many of the officers went to Harvard. And the idea that they had was that if we've got really smart, educated officers, then our regiment and our soldiers will do well, and we'll win this war in 3 months, and it will be done. So that was their attitude. So Paul, and this is true. He got a lot of his friends, and they all signed up, and they all wanted to lead. Of course, they had no experience in military, but that didn't matter. They were educated, and so they kind of brought that forth. And they learned early on that, you know, war is not easy, and that, yeah, you know, they were their first battle, they were destroyed. And but they, you know, kind of went from there. He was captured, but what happened with that was fascinating too. He was a political pawn, and I wanted to kind of work through that. And there was a total of three people that I really focused on, and they were all joined together in the story by a fictional plot that I had, but it was interesting. It was a medallion that created by the Revolutionary War Paul Revere, and it's passed down, really. So whoever has this coin, this medallion, tells their story from their viewpoint. So it gives them some inspiration during the war, you know, some meeting. So I talked about Morton Tower. He was also from the Boston area, and he was not in Paul's regiment. He was in a different one, but he fought in many of the battles that were laid out in Antietam, Gettysburg. So the book kind of, you know, goes into those battles, but from a really personal viewpoint. It wasn't that this is an overview, and you will learn the overview, but it's really focusing on his viewpoint, you know, what he's experiencing. But you also understand.
I want to ask a question.
Yes.
It's actually for Brian. Usually when Brian and I talk about history, he knows everything and I know almost nothing. Brian, what is the Green Dragon Tavern?
Green Dragon Tavern. Isn't that the original tavern that they sat and talked about the original revolution and made their plans for the new government?
Dang it. I've been there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, when we first moved years and years ago up to Massachusetts, we lived right outside of Boston for a year, and we went to the Green Dragon Tavern, really cool place in Boston. And we also followed the Paul Revere Trail there in Boston, which was interesting. And I bet Tom knows all about both of those.
Yes, yes. And again, when my opening chapter is about Paul. And people know about his ride, and I researched that, but I didn't want to start off with that. I thought that was too obvious, too common. I wanted to focus on things that he did after that. So
yeah.
My first chapter, when I outlined Paul, he is older. He is now a silversmith, and he's making these church bells now for the Boston area. And that's when he makes the medallion, because he wants people to remember him for what he does for the community and these church bells. And he thought, you know, people say that I'm a hero from the revolution, but he didn't think of himself as such.
Yeah.
Because so many of his friends had died during that time, and he didn't, and he thought, well, you know, who am I? And this is all true. This is his philosophy. I've actually read all the diaries that Paul had written and his grandson had also written. Paul, his grandson, had a brother, Ed. He was a doctor, and he was also part of his regimen. So I read their journals and their stories and their feelings and their everything. So that's all part of the book. So it's not just about Paul, the grandson, fighting, but it's about his relationship with his brother, who was the
surgeon. Where did you find the journals? I know a lot of authors would be interested in reading old journals, old letters and everything. Where were you able to obtain those from?
I found them online.
You
can, they're actually handwritten, but there are pages of them. You can, people published, so you can read them. And and I read it about from his mother's letters that his mother wrote, you know, with the thing. So you're back home. So you can kind of get a taste of everything. People back in the
So you had an idea to write a book about him and include these other characters, and you were able to go online and find specific letters and journals from him and his family members. Certainly not advocating that any author go and research Paul Revere and try to compete with his book, because I don't think they can. But I do know that a lot of authors would love to figure out, you know, how to find these journals and letters online. Some people find, you know, old journals and letters in like garage sales and stuff, and then create books out of those, which if I had the time, I'd love to do something like that. But yeah, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
So much of history is actually online now. I've done a lot of research, and people from the old days, they would have family Bibles, and in the Bible they would write their kids, grandkids, people that, you know, born and died without ever
family tree.
Without ever having an official birth certificate. It's in the Bible, and it's online, so you understand kind of you know, where to find these things. It's important for researching, at least for me. And each one of these books takes years to research. It's not something that you can just do in a day or a week or a month.
Oh yeah,
Richmond book took 4 years. So it's one of these that it takes time. Every day you do something and you learn, and it grows. And I started off with just Paul Revere, and I had my own story about kind of what I would do. And the more that I researched, the book kind of went its own way. You know, what I had planned for wasn't really the best storyline as it turned out. I found these other storylines, which I thought were better. These other people, Morton Tower and Elizabeth Van Blue, who was a Richmond spy, you know, they all have their own stories, which I thought was fascinating, because it's all true to life, and it's important that the people know about them.
Okay, so we're at about an hour here. So do you want to just Angie stepped out for a second. I'm not quite sure what's going on, but you want to just anything you want to say, just to go ahead and wrap things up here?
Yeah, I have two books that are in the works that I'm working on now. So they'll be out in the next year or two. So one is historical fiction, which is taking place around 1902. It's a based on real life people, but it's my own take on it. So they were explorers, female explorers, and they had their own history about it, and I want to talk about that in the book, but I want to do it in my own way. And I'm telling my story about 10 years later, and I'm having them work together. So the idea is not necessarily about what they did, but their personalities. They were very opposite in personalities, so you're really going to get a lot of the conflict from within them. And they're all very true. This is their own personality, but they were just different. And so to me, it's a new kind of book. It's not does not have a war background like many of my other books do. Mm-hmm. It's more about exploration and about people's own personalities and conflicts.
Right. Now, I want to go back to the fact that you have five kids.
Yes.
And you have written all these books with five kids.
Yes.
And I also have five kids. Mine are all grown now. Well, yeah. You know, physically.
Mine too.
With the prolific writing that you've done, I would say that no author can ever have an excuse for, oh, I have too many kids to write, because you've proven them wrong.
Well, thank you. And when they're asleep at after bed, then that's my hour that I can write and research. But now they're all grown, so now I have a little bit more time, but they still need me for other things.
They always need us, don't they?
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, so that's interesting. I was actually going to ask you earlier, what time of day do you write? So you would write after the kids went to bed. That's probably the best time to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Because any other time would my mind or my body is being pulled in other directions. So that's when I have, you know, the me time that I need.
Yeah, and mornings are always chaos when you have kids. So yeah.
So I do it, and it's not a lot every day, but it's something. And then that's the thing, is you get half an hour, an hour, and you just use it. And if you do it every day, then there's no reason why you can't get something out. And that's my story. I've been writing for 20 years now, published for 15, and I still love it. And I get a lot of good feedback and from people that like my books and the way that I write them. And so that really gives me that good feeling that I know that I'm doing it right, and I'm making contributions.
Yeah, and you're educating people.
Yeah,
in such an interesting way to be taught about history. It's far more interesting than just reading a textbook. It's just, you've done a fantastic job, and we love working with you. You are such a sweetheart. You're a really, really nice guy.
Well, thank you.
All the way through, and we've always had really good communications and a lot of fun when we've worked with you. You're just awesome.
Yes. Well, you've got a excellent team, Angela, and I love working with you guys too. And you've always been very, from the very first book to this last book, you've always been very honest and upfront with me about everything, and very helpful. And so that makes me come back again and again, and I sing your praises to other authors as well. So
we sure appreciate that. And what I've always said is we treat our authors like family, because they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's how we do business. And that's why we have so many great authors, because they're awesome. Yeah.
All right. Well, Tom, we definitely appreciate you having come on and discussed your books with us. And we look forward to doing some more business with you when your other books come out.
And we will put links to all of Tom's books underneath this episode on writersweekly.com/podcast.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Everybody. And I appreciate you having me on the podcast. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, we did too. This is fun.
Yeah.
Learned a lot.
Have a chance to talk about history.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. And if you'd like to write 7 books for us and get them out there to the public, check out booklocker.com. That's booklocker.com. There's a contact link there, and if you click that link, anything you send in, Angela will see it, and she'll be happy to answer your questions. Also, check us out on writersweekly.com. That's where you can find all kinds of articles and stuff from us, as well as all the podcast episodes on writersweekly.com/podcast, as well as updated jobs and paying markets. Angela, you got anything to wrap us up with today?
I was only going to tell you that a neighbor just texted me there's fire down in the holler. So
is that why you jumped up and ran out of here? Okay.
We had I don't know what's going on, but we have fire extinguishers. Maybe that'll work. I don't know.
Well, it's fire season here, so every so often we get some wildfires kind of near our house.
Yeah.
It's a little spooky. So,
all right,
well, that's it for this episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. We will see you next week again. And farewell and adieu. And I screwed up the ending, but that's okay.
That's okay. I'm gonna run upstairs and look off the porch.
There you go. All right. So if we still have a house next week, we'll see you next week on the Writers Weekly Podcast. Thanks a lot, Tom.
All right.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, guys. Thank you very much for having me.